What is up, everybody, and welcome to another riveting episode of Uncanny, the unofficial X-Men 97 podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Condon, and today we're going to be going over episode 7, entitled Bright Eyes. So just a forewarning, I may or may not have a little bit of a cold, so if I sound like someone who has a cold, please know that I'm not contagious. This is a podcast, you're not going to get sick, but we have a lot to talk about. So again, we in this podcast are going to be going over spoilers, tidbits, little Easter eggs and different things in the show. So if you haven't yet watched the episode, please stop. Have a cup of tea like I am. I'm drinking some really good herbal tea, you know, because I have a cold. Ah, delicious. And then if you've watched the episode, please continue. If not, please take a pause. And we're going to start with spoilers in 1, 2, 3. Okay, so for the intro for this episode, this is the first time in the series so far, and in my notes, I kind of, you know, confirm this, that we didn't see anything new, any new scenes, any new tidbits, any new Easter eggs in this intro currently, right? We, you know, we've seen some stuff that we saw in other intros. We saw Cable again, fighting Apocalypse. We saw Master Mold and Nimrod, so two Sentinels, one the Sentinel that kind of creates other Sentinels, Master Mold, the big giant looking Sentinel, and then the other Sentinel that was kind of like hanging out in Master Mold's little like Sentinel kind of easy bake oven press, that kind of guy that looked, you know, he was all kind of chrome-ish, right? That was Nimrod. So Nimrod is an advanced Sentinel from the future. So we saw that in previous intros. And then again, we see a time-traveling Bishop, Logan, and Aurora, or Storm. Yeah, we've seen that. We see Alandra and the Phoenix. We see Scott. All things we've seen before. And including the inclusion of Nightcrawler as one of the main characters in place of Gambit. This is a carry-on from last episode. And I gotta say, it is... It's hard to see, and as we get into this episode, this is another tearjerker. So, we all knew this was coming. It's Remy's funeral, and it opens in a graveyard in the rain, we're assuming in New Orleans, right, in Louisiana, where Remy was from, and Kurt, Nightcrawler, is presiding over the funeral ceremony as a priest. So it looks like between when he was a monk, which for those of you that may not have a background in religious studies or theology, you can be a monk and not be a priest. So many brothers or sisters, depending on the monastic order you're involved in, don't require for you to go through with ordination. But, I mean, with Kurt having the vestments of a priest, I guess I'm only assuming that the writers are making it canon that in this kind of X-Men 97 universe, Kurt went through the process of ordination and is a Catholic priest. Interesting. Yes, this is based in the comics a little bit, though he kind of gets in and gets out of that calling, so to speak. But it looks like they're kind of going full steam ahead with that. I think that's cool. I mean, you know, it is founded in the comics, and Kurt, as a religious person, you know, that is a calling that many people have and pursue it. Very cool. So yes, we open up and we are into the sads, like immediately into the sads. And Beast and Scott and Logan are carrying Remy's casket to the final resting place. And Rogue is nowhere to be seen. Right, so this is tough. So we see some of Remy's family from his days in the Thieves Guild in New Orleans, but we don't see Rogue, who was basically kind of like Remy's partner, so to speak. And in this show, they didn't get married or have kids, but you know that does come up. And, you know, Kurt presides over the ceremony, says some really nice things, I love the way that the animators are deciding to animate Nightcrawler. It's very comic accurate. Like OG Nightcrawler with the glowing eyes, and he looked great. All of the characters are looking great. This episode is very well drawn. Like, the pacing was different. This was definitely not a Monster of the Week episode. It gets into it, and it's hard. So we see all of the X-Men there who attended the funeral mourning, along with Jubilee, who is joined by Roberto. So it looks like they're becoming an item, which I love. It's great. It makes sense, and I think it's organic. It comes across as organic. It's like a couple that, you know, you maybe have not thought would have worked, like, on paper, but then when they put it on the screen, I love it. I think it's great. I think it's actually working quite well. And Jubilee's not taking this. Rogue not being there. She is not taking this well. You know, she's in a relationship with Roberto. She herself didn't really have a strong family dynamic. She is from the foster system. You know, she was adopted. And her foster family, as she mentions later in the episode, haven't really been keeping tabs on her. That's a real thing that many who went through the foster system deal with on a regular basis. The trauma of not having that family dynamic that's there for you, that cares for you, that is there to be with you, and even in your time of need. And for Rogue not to be at Remy's funeral, that's hitting her deep, you know. And Logan tries to comfort her. We see that it's hard, you know. Death is a very real thing that many have to work through. And this episode's a lot to do with death and grief. I would say that this episode is basically like grief, the montage. I mean, this is all about trauma. It's all about coping with loss. So I think, you know, get ready, get your tissue boxes ready. I was crying a couple of times in this. And Kurt, you know, who just presided over this funeral for someone he knew, basically had to remind those who weren't in Genosha that things were horrible in Genosha, that, you know, people aren't just dealing with grief. They're dealing with something else. And I think what he's hinting at is rage and anger. And Rogue is not messing around. I mean, we see in the next sequence, Rogue basically just go to town on these humans. Not only does she attack, let's just say, like, a neutral installment, she attacks a U.S. secret base, I'm assuming in Nevada, and just like going to Area 51 and just like taking it out solo. It's pretty epic. And, you know, we have to be cognizant as we're watching this about Rogue's unique backstory. So Rogue wasn't always invulnerable, could fly, had super strength. And this, again, this is territory that the show's hasn't really shown in this 97 reboot, but in the OG series, we discuss it. And yes, Carol Danvers, Captain Marvel. Yes, that Captain Marvel. Rogue, when she's with the Brotherhood of Mutants, absorbs all of Carol Danvers' powers. Just absorbs all her powers, keeps holding on, and basically puts Carol Danvers in a coma. So in the early OG X-Men series, we saw Carol Danvers and Rogue hash this out once Carol kind of came to. But in the early 90s, this was canon, Rogue basically siphons and maintains as permanent all of Carol Danvers' abilities. So what we're seeing in this is very interesting. This is essentially what Carol Danvers, yes, Brie Larson's Carol Danvers, could do if she got pissed off enough. And Rogue just, yeah, has no qualms about just obliterating an entire military installment. Probably killing a bunch of people. We don't get into that, but she's throwing a tank at another tank. There are people in those tanks, right? when you throw objects through walls, you know, one of those walls could be a friggin' bathroom. You know, some poor guy sitting on the john just gets lobotomized because someone's upset. You know, this is something I think that a certain person brings up later in the episode, which I was very happy to see, very, very much a fan of his. So yeah, Rogue's anger is palpable and understandable. She basically just watched her lovers get vaporized by an evil robot along with thousands of other, probably tens of thousands of other mutants on this island of Genosha. And that's what we saw in episode 5, right? And we're reminded of this, you know, in the next sequence. And I just, before we move on, I did want to note a little funny moment with General Thunderbolt Ross, who's in this little, like, you know, invulnerable cave underground, like, and the soldier's like, oh God, what are we gonna do? And he's like, do you have any idea what this place was built for? Someone way stronger than this lady. And she just crashes through the ceiling like it's nothing. And is like, yeah, guess what? I can do this. Yeah, in the comics, Rogue is kind of near as strong as the Hulk, which means Carol Danvers is near as strong as the Hulk. Yes, this is kind of the... If Carol Danvers was pissed off enough, she could do what Rogue just did to this military base. So that's kind of, you got to have a little bit of respect for Captain Marvel and her restraint, because she is pretty freaking powerful. And this show kind of shows that through a unique lens, right? So next scene, we see Scott Summers talking to the President of the United States through hologram, and the President is essentially kind of shirking off the political football of caring about mutants because it's optically unfortunate at the moment. Yeah. I mean, hey, I respect the writers for going there, because you could say a lot about what's going on now in our world being not quote-unquote optically appropriate. People are getting fired. Literally, they're losing their jobs. People are losing tenure. People are not getting a PhD application approved for universities because they care about certain issues going on in our world, namely the targeting of certain people. It's a real thing. And so when Scott is like, hey, Mr. President, can you get pressure on the UN to help try and find more mutants under the rubble? President's like, well, we're in a politically delicate situation. We really shouldn't. It's kind of a little, my constituents are getting a little, we know where this is going. And again, I'm happy that we're unpacking this in this manner. Again, X-Men, mutants, they've always been an allegory for those currently in our time who are being otherized or marginalized by a majority group, right? And so when the President's like, you know, we can't be seen interacting with mutants. I mean, boy, I need to get reelected so that someone worse doesn't come in who doesn't like you people. Like, we know where this is coming from. We get it. We don't we all get it? We should get it. I mean, let's, you know. And it's funny that, you know, Scott is also not throwing punches. He literally just tells the President on a hologram, well, I guess if Genosha looked more human, I guess the coded word for that would be, I don't know, white and male. You know, who's in power now around the world? You'd be more concerned about the death tolls versus polls, right? You'd be more concerned about the bodies than you would about votes. Again, this is legitimate concern that people are throwing at the current president and other political leaders about kind of being at a distance from major world events like what's happened in the Middle East. Again, I don't know if the showrunners were writing this with a mind on how tensions were building in the Middle East. They probably had no idea that October 7th was going to happen. And it just, I mean, the parallels in the writing to what's happened in the Middle East, you can't ignore it. You really can't. And, you know, that's probably why Disney's been so hesitant about promoting this product. But it's, again, it's great. It should be promoted. This is important for all of us to really wrestle with. You know, and the president, you know, like any other politicians, like, listen, Scott, I'm just playing the long game here, man. You know, I'm just a politician, you know, and Scott's just like, okay, great. I guess we got this on our own. Thanks for nothing, Mr. President. Like, it's important to see that, because in the canon comics, this has always been an issue. Where the X-Men are like, hey, UN Secretary, hey, Mr. President, hey, Prime Minister, help us. And oftentimes they get nothing. Or they get, well, I can't be really seen publicly helping a mutant. Again, these are all allegorical. They're supposed to have us feel something. And Scott gets to utter, again in the show, a moniker that has a great deal of meaning for many people, which is, never again. That term is to bring awareness to what happened in the 1940s to the Jews in the Holocaust. Again, when the writers choose to use terms like that, never again, it's reminding all of us what these stories are all coming from, right? What these allegories are meant to have us think about. So we see Scott and the X-Men go back to Genosha, right? To those who are being pulled out of the rubble and are now refugees in their own land. There nothing was saved. There is no building that was left untouched. And I'm glad they're showing that, because in episode 5, I was wondering, well, it looks like not all of the buildings are being destroyed, right? Maybe some buildings are left, like a hospital, perhaps. Wrong-o. Everything's decimated. Everything's gone, just like in the comics. Yeah, the Sentinels just wiped the whole place, infrastructure gone. You know, this happens in war and in major atrocities where infrastructure is decimated. People don't even have a place to sleep. That's why now in Genosha, it's like a tent city. They're just tents, hospital tents, sleeping tents. It's that this is a real thing for people currently. Around the world, but namely in places like Gaza. So Beast has a lot of really great quotes. He quotes the late Fred Rogers, or Mr. Rogers, from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He also quotes the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So we're digging up all of these social justice and civil rights heroes. And I'm very happy they've gone there, because that's what X-Men's always been about. That's what inspired Stan Lee and Jack Kirby to develop the X-Men. This is where it comes from. So there's this is not political. This is not pandering. This is being accurate to the source material. I do want to commend, you know, Feldman and this other writer, this J.P. Ballard, for going there and not kind of just scooting over it. So after this happens, we get into some interesting cameos here with... Ba-ba-da-da. You guessed it, Captain Frickin' America. Like, I did not expect this to happen. But in the comics, you know, Rogue is one of the founding members of the Avengers Unity Squad, which was a group founded by Steve Rogers when mutants were often in targeted situations, like following the Mutant Massacre, following the Massacre of Genosha. Captain America's always been someone who's been a champion for those who have been marginalized. Because Steve, when he was growing up, as the son of an immigrant in New York City, the Irish were treated horribly. And that was his mom. You know, that was his parents. So he kind of understands what it's like to be essentially the lowest caste within a group, within your home country. Steve knew that way back early in the 40s, before he joined the Super Soldier program. So it's great to see him here. And it also is good to see the banter between him and Rogue, and Rogue catching the shield and just holding on to it the whole episode until, you know, she's like, well, you know, I guess your hands are tied, so you're not going to need your shield. chuck, 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 chuck. Just chucks it into the mountains. I love that moment. That was probably one of my favorite moments from this show so far. I love that. And when Cap takes Rogue down into the very Hydra-looking, I'm going to be honest, it kind of was reminiscent of Captain America Winter Soldier when Black Widow and Cap go down and meet with Arnim Zola. Now, there was no Arnim Zola down here, but a lot of the techs seem pretty old and picked over, and I'm thinking Hydra, but I do know what the OZT are. You know, that's, what are the OZT? And they kind of get into that a little bit. So OZT stands for Operation Zero Tolerance. And you've heard tolerance, you've heard coexistence a lot in this show. Talked about by Beast, brought up by other characters. The character that developed and has been working on this OZT is none other than Bastion. Bastion's a pretty bad guy. He's like one of the worst X-Men bad guys in the entire franchise. It's basically like the Super Sentinel, who's also human. It's like the Antichrist, basically. And truthfully, like, basically Bastion was born when Master Mold and Nimrod were like sent through this like other dimension because the X-Men just didn't know how to get rid of these things. Like, how do you get rid of a Super Sentinel like Nimrod that can't be destroyed? Or Master Mold, who just seems to be like this horrible, almost AI evil. They sent it through this Siege Perilous that I believe the Fantastic Four discovered, which is just like this negative zone. And they're just like, well, we're going to put you in another dimension. But when they did that, out pops Bastion. And Bastion, like, was like a human-Sentinel hybrid that just kind of came into existence because the X-Men were trying to get rid of their Sentinel issues. And this Bastion, or Sebastian, was basically found, raised by a family, almost like a Superman-like figure. But then, like, his dormant Sentinel tech, like, awakened, and, like, his prime program is just kill mutants. Like, he's a bad guy. So I'm, you know, we saw some glimmers of Bastion in the trailers that have come up until this point, but having Bastion be the major bad behind all of this, I think, yeah, I like that. Bastion has been responsible for many bad things in the comic. He's basically like the ultimate, like, xenophobic racist. Like, think of, like, if you guys have ever watched the show The Boys. So The Boys, so Bastion is kind of like if Homelander wasn't like Superman, but more like a machine. That's, you know, that's Bastion. Bastion's like if Ultron was more human, but still like freaking twisted. So I'm happy to see that they're actually going with that. And, you know, we kind of get to see more references after this at the refugee camp. We have some cameos by Strong Guy. This is one of the mutants who was in X-Force, big guy. He says, hey, Roberto, you got to bulk up. You know, it's kind of funny. Yes, he's a strong guy. That was a little tongue-in-cheek, but what are you going to do? And we see Roberto and Jubilee helping out the refugees, and Roberto dealing with his issue of being a closeted mutant. And I'm going to use the term closeted, you know, because I think Feldman was really trying to bring this into the allegory as well. Roberto coming out to his parents as a mutant, very similar to what others may experience when coming out to their parents as gay or bisexual. There's an apprehension in that, especially if you're from a culture, like, I'm just going to say it, a machismo culture that sees not being straight as weak or as something you have to hide. And, you know, we do get to see Roberto coming out to his mom, and his mom's like, oh, honey, we always knew you were gay. I mean, a mutant. But we're still going to have to put that in a box because we have shareholders. And they're kind of itchy right now about this whole mutant thing. Seltzers, everybody. Like, very well done. I was glad to see that come across the way it did. Because that says a lot too about, you know, kind of what certain people experience in society when they're trying to be themselves, and, you know, they hope their families are going to welcome it, and then their family's like, oh, we've always known, but we still got to keep it under wraps because we have optics and a social life, and we're going to need you to maintain that. And in the case of the DaCostas, they're basically like Bill and Melinda Gates. So they're just be like, hey, you might want to just keep the whole mutant thing under wraps because we got to please our shareholders. We don't want to make anyone nervous and pull out. We make a lot of money. You benefit from that, don't you? Don't you, kid, with your yachts? It's a lot, you know, it's a lot. But I think it was important that they went there. Again, I said this before, we see Beast quoting known figures. So riots are the language of the unheard. That was an MLK quote. And they say it when Beast is talking to this reporter in Genosha, watching this young woman sobbing over who was maybe a family member or a loved one. You know, Beast is just like, all we've ever done is begged for tolerance and acceptance. Maybe that's the issue. When this reporter's like, well, humans are scared of this anger. Humans are afraid that mutants are upset and it's making people uncomfortable. And Beast is just like, I'm so, quote, sorry, air quotes, that you're uncomfortable. Look around you. Everyone has just been devastated. And you're telling me that you're uncomfortable with our grief? Like, you know, it's like, what? So I'm glad they went there. We see Rogue again. So the teleporting in this episode, though, yes, still there's been a lot of jetpacking, was a little bit more palpable because it was a part of a narrative story. So unlike with the last episode where I was kind of being nitpicky, the jetpacking worked here because it kept the story going, right? So we see Rogue going and hunting down Henry Gyrick. And he's basically in this Mexico City-like Lux prison. Basically, it looks like Mar-a-Lago. I'm going to go there. Yes, it looks like Mar-a-Lago. And dude's in the back listening to opera and like playing with his, like, I guess, dead bug collection. Because people do that, you know? I guess if you're a sociopath. Anyways, you know, and she's just like, where's Trask? So Bolivar Trask, the guy who was in the end of last episode running and saying, oh, it's sinister. He's kind of behind the sentinels. And Guy Rick's like, you're never going to get in my head because I got some kind of yada yada. And then Rogue's like, okay, I'm going to use my mutant power and just try and suck it out. And then I guess she blacks out and we get to see Bastion for like a brief second. And Nimrod. So yeah, we're getting a little glimmer of the Sentinel tech. I'm going to drink some tea. Ah, good tea. You got a cold, drink fluids. And, you know, we get a glimmer of what's going on with these hybrid super Sentinels, right? Back to Genosha. And, you know, Scott and Jean were talking about, well, we just need to find one more survivor, right? We're lost. We're struggling. We just got to find one more. And they do. Emma Frost goes into her diamond form during the chaos of the attack and is found relatively unharmed. And, you know, people bond over finding a new person. And again, this is something very real for many people around the world who are in a conflict zone, right? Finding people alive under rubble from military conflict is a celebration. It brings hope. So, you know, that I think these visual motifs, again, they're calling to mind our events going on in the world. And having Emma be found by Scott and Jean, I think it's a little kind of a play on, yes, Emma and Scott in the comics have a relationship once Scott and Jean are no longer a thing. I don't think they're going to go there in this show, but, you know, that there's an interesting parallel there. And, you know, Jean and Scott are kind of bonding over the loss and, you know, how tragedy brings people together. And, you know, we kind of get that. But my favorite scene in this is coming up is in a Mexico City where we have Kurt and Rogue bonding over the loss of Remy. And Kurt you know, finds Rogue after Rogue was, I guess, knocked out when she tried to suck the memory from Gyrick. And Kurt's like, hey, sis, I just want you to know you're not alone. And they like bond, like, and it was during the festival of Dia de los Muertos, which goes on in Mexico City and across South America, where we celebrate those who have passed in a festive, joyous way every year. And to have Kurt be with Rogue to basically let her know that, you know, we know that you've lost and we know that you're upset, but you also gave these people life. You didn't bring death upon them. Death happened to them. You were there to give them life. And I cried. I was crying my eyes out. Like, the music was great. The art looked great. You know, focusing on the inhabitants of Mexico City as they honor their lost loved ones on this festival was great. And then, you know, they hug and they're siblings, you know, and they mention that. And, you know, last couple episodes ago, I was like, are they going to go there? And they do. You know, even Rogue says, you know, what kind of a foster sister am I to you, where I just go nuts and just destroy things? And, you know, Kurt's like, you know, you're someone who's lost, you know, and just he's there for her. I love it. You know, I think it's nice to have that kind of brother-sister relationship. And I'm glad they brought Kurt into the series. And, you know, we get to see Kurt in his OG X-Men uniform, right? With the red and the black kind of outfit. This was Kurt's, I think, first X-Men outfit, which was an inspiration from when he was in the Munich Circus. So very cool to see. And I kind of love that. But we hear from Trask in a message to the X-Men. First off, I don't know how he did that, but I guess, you know, we're going to just assume that. And oh snap, he wants to meet up with the team because he's, you know, he's feeling, I guess, guilty about what happened to Genosha, and he says Sinister's behind it. So the team's obviously like, trap. And Morph is just like, guys, this is a trap. And they're like, well, I guess we're going to have to spring it. So they go to Madripoor. There's a name drop. So Madripoor is like a place in the X-Men universe that's kind of like if Hong Kong was a little more sinister-y. It's basically like an island nation where anything goes. And Logan has a history in Madripoor as Patch, who's like an investigator. Madripoor is this whole place. It's like where bad guys basically hang out and, like, you know, do their thing. So they go to Madripoor, they find this secret lab, and they find Trask kind of like suicidal and just in a manic state of terror. Because he just basically was responsible for just killing all these mutants, even though that's kind of not what he intended. It looks like Bastion took his tech and just kind of took it and ran with it. And he says, now I've become death. This is a nod to Oppenheimer, when Oppenheimer developed the bomb, the atomic bomb. Now I've become death, destroyer of worlds. If you saw the film Oppenheimer, you've seen that quote. And Rogue, like, goes nuts when she sees this guy and just basically throws him off a building. And, you know, I was surprised by that. And they kind of, you know, they kind of soften the blow because, surprise, surprise, Trask is a hybrid sentinel. And, you know, he's not dead. He just became awakened. But, you know, if she would have just chucked him off the building and then the cops would have got involved or something, I think that'd probably be a little bit more realistic. Because what are you going to do, X-Men? Rogue just murdered somebody in cold blood. But we're not going to go there. It's going to be a big, like, Super Saiyan battle. So I thought the battle was fun. You know, freaking Trask turns into a prime sentinel. Okay. You know, it kind of reminded me of the worst Iron Man movie, which is, you know, Iron Man 3 and the whole, like, extremist virus. It kind of reminded me of that a little bit. And so I was kind of like, you know, we get to see some cool power displays. Nightcrawler does his BAMF thing, which is always fun to see. Jean definitely OP'd in this. But, you know, Trask going Super Saiyan, and I'm going to say Super Saiyan because it looks Super Saiyan, I thought it was so just kind of gimmicky and cartoony, especially when they're like Trask and Jean are just zooming around like motes of light. Really? This isn't Dragon Ball Z. I mean, I did have some groaning moments in this, but it kind of makes sense. But the big reveal, so after this battle, guess who shows up in a very Deus Machina style? You guessed it, Nathan Summers, aka Cable, saves the day with an EMP bomb when, Scott's about to get smushed. And so Cable reveals that there's stuff going on and Sinister's behind it, but someone else and someone nefarious, yes, it's Bastion. Bastion is behind all this, which makes sense. I mean, Bastion was a pretty bad guy in the comics, and Bastion seems to have gotten his hands on a certain Magneto who's not dead. Ba-da! So proper, I know. Yes, it looks like Magnus is still alive, and Bastion is torturing him, or I guess giving him a shave, which, is a form of torture, I guess. Kind of weird, but yeah, that's where we are. So I do think that Feldman and JB Ballard did a decent job writing this episode. It was very well produced. I'm much more pleased with this episode than I was with the last episode. But if you liked it, tell me what you thought. If you want to hear more about the insides and the scoops, please send me a message on my Instagram. And as always, keep it classic.